rolling. There's no tape rolling. There's That's a true. Hard drive spinning.
Okay, we're spinning. I don't
like
have that. Anything
for spinning. It's like Leo trying to push netcasts.
Netcasts, I know. We're spinning.
All right, welcome to Mustard Ayonnaise. I am Matt.
I am Richard.
And we're watching New England Green Bay
Absolutely.
In the background. This should be a smoother broad netcast podcast than last time. We won't be interrupted six times by
Well, no construction noises, but there's always the dog and the three cats.
That's true. Where is the dog? Is it
locked? The dog is hiding in the bedroom.
Okay, well done. I kind of have a short list, but every time I say that, you always say, well, this is now officially the longest one ever.
Did you get my follow-up email of suggestions on my part?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Good. Just want to make sure they're on the list.
Wide
to the right.
A field goal.
All right.
We can't let that. We can't keep commenting on the football game. That's bad. That was a horrible honk, though.
It was awful.
All right. James Bond opened this weekend. Casino Royale. Have you seen it?
Yes.
Excellent. I have seen it as well.
Yep.
My work schedule changed, and now supposedly we're out every Friday at 3.
Wow. Not this, you get one Friday a month where you can guarantee you get out by 6?
Yeah, they tweaked it, so now our Thursday sucks.
Oh.
But
well,
nobody cares quite as much about that.
Well,
so
cool.
Friday, my buddy John, huge James Bond freak, like
yep.
owns the books and has read the books.
Yep.
Because 95% of the James Bond fans don't even realize there's a book series they're based on.
13 books. I think this was the first one, wasn't it? Wasn't
yes.
Casino Royale?
To my knowledge, yes.
53 years ago.
So anyway, he was going to go see it in 3:45 at close to where I work. And I was like, you know, it's funny because you end up spending all day just fixating on this one thing. I need to be out of work by 3 so
yep.
I can make this 3:45 movie. It's not the end of the world. I'm not going to miss a plane flight.
Yeah.
The difference is I'll have to pay full price if
yeah.
I don't make this time. But then it totally messes up the rest of my weekend. Anyway, got out just in the nick of time, went over, basically loved the movie.
Yep.
John, huge James Bond fan, loved the movie.
Yep.
Really well done. And it's interesting because they were doing exactly what Jeffrey Wells has been calling for. And he's not alone. And saying this is what needed to happen, essentially
what everybody's been calling for:
reboot the franchise, get rid of these gigantic explosions, all this gadgetry. This they were becoming
make Bond be at least mildly vulnerable.
Yeah, and they were becoming a cliche isn't really. They were becoming a parody of themselves.
I honestly cannot remember the plot lines of any Bond film. This one I can remember everything because it was real. It wasn't
plus
just
you
a,
saw it. 2 days ago or a
this
day
is
ago.
True. No, I was thinking about that. I used to have that comment when I would walk out of a Bond film, literally the second I walk out, I couldn't actually, because they were so convoluted and so clearly secondary to the set pieces that I couldn't actually figure out what the point was here. At least I did. And I love the movie. I'll tell you though, speaking of the experience, cause you're talking about the experience, we looked online to see if there's tickets available at the Linwood Megaplex, and they were all sold out. But they had, but there was like an issue. They said they had tickets at our other local theater, the Montlake Nine, but I couldn't order them online, so we went down there and we got tickets. And they go, "Do you have seats left?" "Oh yeah, plenty of seats." And we walked down. It's the final theater on the right. And as we're walking down, we're seeing them rolling up a one sheet for Flags of Our Fathers and a little handwritten sign that says Casino Royale.
Oh.
Literally, Flags of Our Fathers had sold so many tickets that at the last minute they just put another copy of it in the final theater. It was really kind of depressing for Flags of Our Fathers.
It is.
But it allowed us to see a movie without anybody sitting in front of us and stuff. So
that's great.
But it was a terrible experience as usual. The film, for whatever reason, the bottom right hand corner, I don't know how the bottom right hand section, that quarter of the frame was consistently out of focus. Everything else
would
focus. It's like they smudged
a smudge on the lens. I can't think of any.
It was so frickin' annoying. And then the trailers were all they were all super widescreen trailers, but they had the
wrong lens on.
Yeah, and so what was happening was, well, it was showing up, but they were all showing up on the curtains, which was driving me nuts. I forget now that the new Aldwood Megaplex has come in, they do a good job, and you get used to an even better standard.
I've been to I haven't been focused on that one theater. I haven't had a problem with lens ratio in a while.
Yeah.
Probably since the Grand closed.
Well, here it was clearly because they just quickly had moved the thing and they were figuring it out. But the whole thing about that thing out of focus was really annoying.
I would imagine. So. Yeah. Anyway, really, really good film. Daniel Craig was excellent.
He's incredible.
I couldn't have asked him to do a better job.
Having not been a huge fan of the Sean Connery, I love the Sean Connery stuff, but I didn't see him when I was a kid growing up. I saw him like the last 5 years, and I totally understand and appreciate them. I just think Daniel Craig, so I recognize him and his iconic status. He's the greatest ever. But Daniel Craig, I could not imagine anybody better, at least in modern times. I love Pierce Brosnan when GoldenEye came out. I could care less about like Roger Moore and Timothy Dalton stuff, but this was like perfect to me. He was perfect. Those idiots that were having those websites, you know, condemning him and saying how bad.
They just,
what a bunch of jerks.
It's people that don't have a life. And exactly. You're always going to have something like that. It's just ridiculous.
Exactly.
That being said, because the movie was so good, the bits of it that didn't work really stuck out for me.
What didn't work?
And I'm going to have to discuss some plot points here. Okay. So if you haven't seen it, skip ahead a random amount of time.
But it is a James Bond movie. So.
The Airbus 380 clone.
Yeah.
That why is this plane being rolled out in the middle of the night at Miami International Airport? That made no sense. Yep. It made no sense.
Because it would be more visually interesting.
Plus, Miami, I mean, I understand they used it because it was close to the Bahamas or the Caribbean or wherever he was flying in from. But Miami Airport, why would you do that? Nobody's hub is there.
Plus, it was a bizarre... it was a bizarre form of terrorism that's supposed to impact the stock. You're going to blow it up on the tarmac, which is a little bit different than, I mean, it just seemed like a bizarre way to impact the stock. Cause I would think it might in a little bit impact.
I kind of had a twinge of that's supposed to make the company fail because their prototype blows up.
Yeah. Wouldn't
they have insurance on it? Maybe.
I know.
But
I didn't
get hung up on that. I just couldn't believe that they were, why would they be rolling this plane out in the middle of the night? Unless it was like a demo or a tryout. But they should have had a throwaway line of dialogue that explained that. Because then I would have accepted it and it would have been fine.
It was the closest thing to a torture logical thing to throw in a big set piece as a typical James Bond movie has. So I agree. I was watching that going, oh, that's kind of dumb. But that said.
But then there was the, why is it that there's always a construction zone around when it's time for an exciting fight or chase or something? There were two of them in this movie.
Well, the very beginning one was clearly they hired some of those parkour guys from that Banlieue 13 movie from France. And
well, it's not just that movie.
It's a whole big thing. I'm saying, but the guy who was in the movie, he was the inventor of parkour. So I'm just saying
is this free running thing where basically you're running through urban environments and doing wacky crap like jumping from building to building and making 15-foot jumps and rolling in such a way that it doesn't hurt you and you keep your momentum. And
they didn't use some of it, which you're used to seeing, which is you're jumping off one wall to go to another wall to go to a third wall up higher. But they did a pretty good job of it. But I thought it. But I leaned over to my buddy Mark, Mark was with us, and as they get to the construction zone, and the one guy starts climbing up, my first reaction was, well, I just stay at the bottom, wait for him to come down. There's no other place he can go. It just seemed kind of the stupidest little thing, but it was still an exciting jump.
That's pretty funny.
But anyway, it's still exciting. I actually really enjoy it because unlike most, the jumps, either if they landed, they seem painful if they were bad, or because they're using parkour, you're going, oh yeah, that's a legitimate jump. That's not some movie thing that couldn't happen. At least it added element of reality.
So there was that. There was a little bit of the aspect of, you know, 10 guys shooting at you with some machine guns and none of them can manage a hit.
Yeah.
There was not as much of that as in the past. And then it's not the nail gun towards the end. I hate that. Mm-hmm. I hate it. I hate it because different movies have used this, where it's basically a roofing nailer, a pneumatic nail gun is used as a weapon. Lethal Weapon 2 is different because in Bond and in other movies, they use it like a gun where you're just firing and hitting things 10 feet away. That's not how a nail gun works. Yeah,
instantly it's spinning and it has no
you and I both know that nail guns have a safety catch where they don't fire unless this guard is depressed.
Yep.
So against a sheet of wood or whatever, it's not going to fire a gun.
Yep.
Granted, with your other, with your free hand, you can be holding the catch back. Yep. You could have jammed it open somehow. But you're not just going to pick one up with one hand and start firing this like a gun. It doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
In Lethal Weapon 2, it was a close-in thing where he actually, the guy's head was right there and he nailed it.
Nailed him.
So in that instance, I'll buy it.
Yeah.
And anyway, boy, that looks like a mud game. Look at that.
It sure is, I know. Well, I'll tell you, you know, one thing I thought was interesting. Did you look on Rotten Tomatoes and see that James Bond is best reviewed movie of the year? But according to the tomato meter, it has the highest, it is one spot higher, I think, than Little Miss Sunshine right now in terms of wide release movie.
Mm-hmm.
That said, if you look at the reviews, with few exceptions, it's weird. It's a classic reason why Rotten Tomatoes can be a challenging thing as well, because if you look at the movies, you generally get the sense that everybody is giving it a B or maybe a B plus. There's a few that are out and out raving, but nobody hates it. Everybody likes it. It's that rare thing. Usually movies have like a bell curve progression to their reviews. You get a few that really hate it, a few that love it, and in the middle. And this movie has no bell curve. It is literally flatlining right there at B, which everybody likes it. And I thought that was interesting. So in one sense, you call it the best movie of the year, but there, it's not going to be nominated Best Picture or anything. But
I think a lot of people really have a soft spot for James Bond, and they want it to succeed. They want this movie to be good. And the fact that it doesn't stink really allows them to achieve a unanimity.
Didn't it strike you as too long?
A little bit, and only in the sense that the whole happy bit almost towards the end where they're really trying to play up that he's happy, that was too long. I understand why they did it, because they were really trying to set him up for, you know, they were really trying to, you know, they're trying to do something that establishes why he is the way he is for the, you know, for the other movies that will come. And I get that. And the more significant the switch is, or the fall is, or the transition is, the more significant that effect it will have. That being said, within the context of this one movie, it was too long.
It was, I felt like at the end, although I appreciate, I totally understood why they did it, it felt totally to me a little bit like Lord of the Rings, Return of the King. It's like there's five endings. It felt a little bit. That said, I didn't mind it. And also the middle part, which it had this poker game, which was actually very well filmed.
I thought that was
in retrospect, it just felt like a huge chunk of my time the challenge is that's what the book was about. The central piece was a Baccarat game, I guess, in the original, but it still struck me as just a lot of time. I love the movie. I enjoyed it. It felt to me like somehow, without any suggestion I could offer, that it was like 20 minutes too long. But I loved it. I was like, it was like exactly everything I was hoping for. It delivered on everything in a way that, and I really liked Goldeneye when it came out, but really in a way that James Bond has never delivered on.
Yeah.
So I loved
it. Plus, Ava Green is hot.
She is. She was kind of hot. Yeah. And somebody said somebody pointed out, they said, you know, she was basically an enigma in the movie, and she was perfectly cast because of the way she is. She's somewhat not expressive, but it works perfectly in this movie. And I don't know about that. I know that she was perfect in the movie in a way that rarely women are in these movies. Standard is Mrs. Charlie Sheen, whatever her name was, Christmas.
Denise Richards.
Yeah, Denise Richards. I mean, that's the gold standard for bad. So. Yeah.
One other thing I want to say.
Oh, by the way, so we're watching these ads for
this is a
Volkswagen.
Buy a Volkswagen and they give you a guitar.
Yeah, so they had John Mayer in one. Now this is one has Slash. Did you see the other one that they have?
Of course I have.
The Nigel Tufnel. One. I thought that was very cool. I was talking to Mark about it. I was going, God, it's cool, but I just wonder how many people these days. No, I would assume everybody has entered the cultural lexicon, but you never know. But it was definitely, it's always heartening to see a modern new something Spinal Tap related.
One last thing about Bond. when the first time you see that, the Aston Martin,
mm-hmm.
the new one.
Yep.
And it's, God, I don't know what mod, I think it was a DB9 and I think it was an S.
Yep.
I don't know Aston Martin well enough to really nail down which version or which model that was. But I think I heard every male in that audience kind of go, ooh. And I leaned over to John. I'm like, every guy in this audience just got a stiffy.
You know what I thought was funny was when they first showed Bond driving a car, they put him in like a Ford Focus.
No, that was a Mondeo.
Oh, Mondeo. Okay, so it's like the international one.
The European Mondeo, okay, which is a lot. It's a good car.
It's a good car. It's their international car, but it's not a Aston Martin. And what was funny was when they got in that, everybody's going, ooh, and then they start to realize, oh, this isn't the tricked out car, where, which I thought was good for the character, because they're trying to establish James Bond at like a base level that works his way up. So then later he ends up in like the 62, the original Aston Martin that what's his name, John Connery drove. And then he got to the cool one. And even then I loved it, because Mark was going, oh, you know, there are some gadgets and they're doing this. And I'm going, dude, I don't know what movie you were watching, because they so toned it down and they so made it more grounded in reality. I think he wanted zero gadgets or something, but he goes into this car and there's like a limited couple of things that are clearly designed for his access only. There was no laser, you know, beams on shark heads. There was no, there was no rockets coming out of the car. There was nothing like that. And I thought, thank God for once.
Did you notice that? I mean, they're all Fords in the movie.
Yep.
Mainly the premier automotive group, Jaguars, yeah. and Aston Martin.
Oh, of course.
And
it was heavy on product placement, but in a way that was not
also,
oppressive.
Really, they were British cars.
Yep.
Aston Martin and Jag, even
Which
though they're owned
cool.
by Ford.
Yep.
British cars. You know, and I just thought of one other thing before, as What's we continue that? To beat Bond to death. The torture sequence.
Yeah.
You know, the guy gets up there and he says, I don't understand why people get so involved with torture. All you basically have to do is hit a guy in the nuts.
Yeah,
that's basically what he says, and then he proceeds to do it.
Yep.
And you know, it's exactly right. And I don't know where they go from here in future Bond movies.
Well,
do they just continue to play up on
it?
That?
Was good. Is there if there is one thing about especially earlier James Bond movies, Bond gets captured, Bond is in jeopardy, and all the guy has to do is kill them, but he wants to talk to him for 5 minutes and thus giving time.
And it's funny because pop culture has so latched onto that.
Yep.
You know, it's in Austin Powers with the unnecessarily yep. slow dipping device.
Exactly.
And, you know, sharks with laser beams on their heads. And
so in this case, finally, it just get right to the torture. And which was good, you know, and to some extent you later realize, you know, there's other aspects to it, but you know, it was good. I liked that it wasn't,
you know, it really drew a line between that and the other,
yeah,
the other, you know, not just Bond, but any other torture movie. You're just like, that's a good point. All you have to do is hit a guy in the nuts. All right.
And I did like his reactions. I mean, it was just well played out.
Very well done. Moving on. Trailer for Zodiac is out. This is the new David Fincher movie about the Zodiac killer in 1970s San Francisco.
Yep. Is that
the
right time? Like 71 through 75, something like that.
Jake Gyllenhaal, Mark Ruffalo,
Robert Downey Jr.
Robert Downey Jr.
Some chick,
Chloe Savini.
Yeah, Chloe Savini. God dang, every time I see her, I think she's a great actress, but every time I see her, I have an image of the brown bunny in my head.
I've never seen that.
I feel bad. You know, you all these actresses and actors go, well, if we could do something more explicit and modern, people, I mean, we're actors, they'll get over it. And it's like, you know, I'm sorry, I'm maybe because it's the only one I've seen, but it's hard for me to get over that image.
Okay.
But anyway, I digress.
I thought, you know, I thought the trailer was fine. I got no sense of Fincher at
I got a tiny sense of Fincher. There's a couple of scenes where just literally he's framing like there's an overhead projector shot of one of the Zodiac's letters, and it's perfectly framed in the thing, and it's kind of brighter in the middle and dark on the sides. And then there was a couple of shots where there's an overhead shot of a car driving, and the camera is literally 400 feet in the air over this like city scene,
oh,
and turning and following where the camera is. And it's, to me, it's a classic kind of Fincherism.
You're right.
But what I was struck by was I assumed he would nail the look and feel of a mid 70s police procedural with the element of the Fincher of like Seven or whatever. And I didn't quite see that. I saw the hair and everything and the actors looked right, but I didn't quite see it. Either way, I am so fantastically excited about this movie, even if the trailer didn't quite deliver what I was looking for.
Yeah. And I'm going to see it as well. because it's clearly going to be a good movie. One thing I noticed, based on one of the stars' names I saw in the end credits that I didn't see in the trailer, I think I know who's portraying the bad guy.
Oh, who's what's the name?
Anthony Edwards.
Oh yeah, no, he was in the trailer.
Was he?
Yeah, of course he was. Yeah, yeah.
What was he?
Well, he had hair in the trailer, so but I think he's like an editor in that movie.
Oh.
So yeah, it's not Anthony Edwards.
Then I'm wrong.
I'm not so sure they even have the killer in this movie because it might be. But who knows?
They showed a guy wearing a.
Well, no, I'm that, but I'm not so sure they actually go and reveal the person. Or they've never found the person, so I'm not sure they're going to do that.
Yeah, okay.
But yeah, Anthony Edwards has hair in the movie, which is always difficult to spot him with hair.
Okay, moving on. I just read this morning on Dark Horizons that they are going to do a remake of John Carpenter's The Thing.
Yeah, I heard about that a little bit ago.
And that movie still kind of scared me. That's a pretty effective film.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I saw it when I was young, so it probably left more of an impression than if I were to see it new today. But
it's still good.
The claustrophobic aspect of Antarctica
mm-hmm.
was, you know, well done. The general creepiness, the alienness of this thing, I thought was well done, and the bleakness of the ending.
Yep. And Kurt Russell has almost never been better. I mean, he was so good in that movie that I remember when I first saw that movie, when it first came out, that was a time in my life, which seems like a long time, but it was probably only like a year in my life, when I was so unbelievably into gory special effects makeup. and John Carpenter was like this awesome guy, but more importantly, Rob Bottin and Rick Baker are these godlike people when it came to movie makeup. And this came out after American Werewolf in London, which was Rick Carpenter's movie, and The Howling, which was Rob Bottin's movie, which as a gory makeup effects person, it's a Joe Dante movie. I love that even more. It was way better to me as a guy into this stuff. So when I heard, I'd read my magazines, Fangoria magazine and Cine Fantastic, and they'd be talking about this movie, and I'd be getting so frickin' excited because this was a movie where they were going to let Rob Bottin go nuts. And it was as much his movie. It was his ideas and his creations.
Oh.
And, cause they said, you figure this out what you want to do. So like the guy's head that sprouted the legs and walked along and all these other, you know, his head turned into a spider and all stuff. This was his idea. And I was so excited, but the downside is when I saw the movie, I was so jaded that nothing scared me. Plus I'd been so primed for this movie. I'd read so much about it that I could only look at it as an appreciation for effects. And it was so seminal. It was so important to me. I was so freaking excited seeing that movie. And they have a really good, yet again, it's one of those great DVDs that Kurt Russell participates in the commentary. He's such a fun guy, and he really seems to have fun on these commentary tracks. So it's one of those great, you know, he's done a couple John Carpenter commentary tracks with him, like Big Trouble in Little China and Escape from New York and stuff. And this is another one that's really fun. So I don't know what the new movie would be. I could not imagine liking it any more than I enjoyed the original.
Because the guy doing the script is Ronald Moore.
Oh, who's Ronald Moore?
Showrunner of Battlestar Galactica.
Oh, see, that might be great. It's funny to think, you know, the first The Thing is a remake of a movie that was before that.
I've actually seen the original.
With James R. Ness. And back then it had to be psychological more because they didn't have effects. So it was just a big crazy guy with these little claws on his fingers. But I'll definitely look forward to seeing it. But and I wouldn't hold it against it that it's a remake of one of my favorite movies of all time. But it's got a pretty high standard to connect to. That, although the one scene where he's testing him out and he's got like a
live wire.
Yeah, live wire, and he's testing their blood was uniquely well done, where he's got them all tied down and when they discover who the one alien is and he starts transforming, the guy next to him is going, "Let me out! Let me out!" It was beautifully well done.
All right. You know, and this is the last movie-related thing on my list, unless we think of something else. You know, there's like here the best picture talk.
Yep.
And I realized I don't care.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not sure how much I've cared in the past. I remember There was a couple of years I managed to, on my own, have seen all of the nominees prior to them being nominated and feeling smug about that.
Yep.
I don't care what gets Best Picture anymore. If it's, you know, if it was a director I really felt a connection with, like, well, David Fincher or Kevin Smith. I feel like Kevin Smith is my buddy.
Yep.
You know, if he were up for something, that, you know, I would be invested.
That won't happen anytime soon.
I realize that. Yep. I'm simply, you know, I like Martin Scorsese, but I'm not going to, okay, whatever. Or, you know, but anyway, there's all this hoopla about Dreamgirls and, you know, is Flags of Our Fathers going to make it or not? Cause it flopped now they're doing Letters from Iwo Jima as a limited December release to qualify it under the wire.
Yep.
And I just don't care. Yeah. I really don't care. And I'm starting to, you know, does the general population care?
I care as much as I always have. And when it comes down to Oscars, I get excited. I just do.
Okay.
Only reason for me, it's only because I, like everybody else, you were talking about the smug thing, and I've been there too, where it's like, oh, I've seen them all and this and that. But at a certain level, if there's a movie I really like and suddenly it gets propelled into a higher level and other people like, I start going, yeah, see, they like. But honestly, I care from the moment the nominees happen and then basically sort of not care and then the Oscars. So it's not like a big thing, but I do like to see them. I do like to get mad when Dances with Wolves win Best Actor or Best Picture, and it's such a terrible movie. I mean, not terrible, but it didn't seem, you know, compared to the other nominees. I think Goodfellas, it won over Goodfellas of all movies. So I like getting excited about that stuff, but that's just me. I just like movies, but I don't care now. Well, but I will care later.
Okay, and you know that's cool, but to me it seems out of whack to the amount of press or the amount of speculation that goes on.
It could be, but now we're in the internet world and we're on MCN every day and we're on Jeffrey Wells. So the speculation, if you literally cut out like four little websites of our life, it would be zero speculation.
I guess that's true.
So I'm just thinking it might be but I don't know. It might not be. I wonder what speculation was like before the internet, how that kind of stuff played out. Cause it seems totally dependent on the internet, but how did it work 15 years
variety
ago.
And let's move on. All right, so we're gonna move over into video games.
Oh yeah.
So
how's that Gears of War doing? You played that since?
Oh yeah, I was on it for quite a while yesterday.
Did you see it? It jumped to the top. It's like the first. That's the most played. Finally, a game on the Xbox 360 has beaten Halo 2 as the most played Xbox Live game. Finally. Which is ironic, because it's not even a Xbox 360 game.
I've done very little multiplayer so far because I'm just going through the single player campaign on casual.
Yep. Oh, I never go to the high. I might try to replay them, but I always start out casual is my thing.
I was starting to go through Halo 2 again on the hardest setting.
Yep.
And I got distracted. But, you know, eventually I'll go back and do it on the harder difficulties. But, you know, at this point, I'm still getting, you know, Halo 2, I'm not second nature yet. I'm good, but I don't care. Blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
I'm done making that point. Anyway, it's a good game. Some friends and I noticed that we were getting disc errors, though, like can't read disc. And it's a new disc, and it's pristine. And so you don't know if it's an overheating thing, but it's frustrating when you're playing.
No,
and you get
dude,
some...
they had like some announcements. You're not alone. There's others that are getting that same thing.
Well, yeah. And then it's disconnected me twice from Xbox Live in the middle of playing.
Yeah.
That's kind of lame. So you don't know if that's a game bug or what, but you're like, if it's patchable, let's patch this quick.
Yeah. But the disc errors, there have been people reporting that with that particular thing. There's something they did screwed up in it.
Maybe when they manufactured the discs, the layers are a little too close to the tolerance. Anyway, so that's Gears of War. It's doing very well. And by and large, living up to the hype, because the hype machine around this was nuts.
Yeah.
Absolutely nuts.
Yep.
But what's more significant is the fact that Microsoft has announced they're going to start selling TV shows and movies through their Xbox Live service.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, people have been, ever since the Xbox was announced, people were like, well, this is Microsoft's stealth attack into the living room.
Yeah, of course.
And not that it was that stealthy. Everyone knew, okay, well, eventually this is what's going to happen. And when they announced this, essentially the circle is complete.
Yeah.
They have finally, this is their end goal. And you know what? You know, I think the way they're implementing it is by and large good, because the first thing that springs to my mind is, well, a 20 gig hard drive is way too small.
Yeah.
And judging by Major Nelson's podcast last week, there's a lot of people saying that as well.
Yeah.
So there's some screenshots going around of presentations on the internet showing that there is a larger hard drive out there, like a 60 or an 80 or something, which probably will be, you know, for sale at some point. But beyond that, even that really isn't enough. So apparently the movie model is a rental model.
Yeah.
So you download this movie. Once you begin watching it, you have 24 hours to watch it as many times as you want, and then it self-destructs or something.
How much are they charging?
They don't know yet. The numbers that were out so far were temporary placeholder numbers.
See, ultimately to me, if you assume most people have cable, a lot don't, but even on demand, the standard is $3.99 for a movie on video on demand or others, and it would be the same exact thing. You rent it, you got 24 hours to watch thing. It's the same thing on DirecTV. So I would assume and hope they would go for that. Otherwise, almost everybody that's got hooked up to an Xbox almost certainly has access to the same movie in another form elsewhere.
But what's innovative to me is the way they're doing TV shows, which is an ownership model. And the way they handle the small hard drive is they keep a database of what you've purchased, and you can delete your local copy and re-download it and watch it again whenever you want without having to pay for it again.
That would be that's one thing that smart. I hate about Apple, and it just kills me that they don't let you do that.
Well, they don't. Apparently, if your hard drive crashes or your computer gets stolen or something, if you insist upon it with customer service, they will let you re-download everything again.
And you know what? Come up with some security scheme that you could figure out that I'm not ripping you off, and let me friggin' download.
I agree. That's
because I've reformatted my disk. I've had things going on, and I don't want to go to rigmarole. I've purchased it. Give it to me.
In thinking about what Microsoft is doing there, I think that's a good idea. It solves the hard drive problem mostly.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you don't feel quite as vulnerable.
Yeah.
You know, that being said, I still can't get over the fact I like the freedom of my Dish Network, and I can watch anything I want, and I can watch new shows. I can run across something that's new and interesting and say, oh, okay, cool. Whereas when you're buying things piece by piece over iTunes or Xbox Live, you're relying on a friend to tell you, or you're relying on picking up buzz like, oh, this show is good, I should check it out.
Yeah.
But you're not going to run across it on your own.
Yeah.
Unless they do some sort of like Amazon.com favorites list. If you like Battlestar Galactica, you might like Stargate. You might like Heroes.
And of course, that's the big challenge, is we're moving from this passive, we come across stuff to.
And you're right. We are. We're definitely moving in that direction.
It's really scary if you're a marketer for a TV company.
And so even though it's cool, and the HD movie thing, to me, if they solve that extras thing, which we have discussed in the past, I have no problem downloading movies.
Yeah, but generally the same.
It's, you know, suddenly maybe we're dealing with bypassing HD DVD and Blu-ray faster than we thought.
Well, yeah, it depends on what resolution they're pumping those things out. But yeah, I agree. At a certain point, it's like if they can figure out the extras issue and make it compelling, then I generally pretty much agree. You know, I'll tell you the thing that I hate, I think you were going to talk about.
Yeah, it's next.
The point system. So tell me about the point system.
Okay, so Microsoft's Xbox Live service works on a point system. If you want to buy an Xbox Live Arcade game, it's 400 points. It's 1,200 points. It's not a dollar amount. So you have to purchase 500 points at a time or 1,000 points at a time at whatever it is, and then you have this amount of points in your system, and then you exchange the points for a game or whatever, or in the future, TV shows and movies. You know, a movie is going to be 1,000 points. It's not going to be $4. It's going to be 1,000 points, and you'll have to do math in your head to figure out what that is. And it's not an equivalent system. 1 point does not equal a penny or a dollar.
It equals like 7.9.
And so, and there's a lot of discussion on a lot of the tech podcasts about this. So we don't need to completely rehash it, but essentially the reason they're doing this is most people agree that it's because it makes the consumer spend more money. It makes you,
That's one reason.
Because you're either going to have a surplus or a surfeit.
You will always have a little bit left, which will either compel you, meaning you're essentially giving them a free loan of that money, or you are compelled to go, well, I just need to put a little more in to buy this.
First from reality, because 200 points sounds better than $5.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem like you're spending money, because you're spending money much. You're spending money maybe once a week or once a month to re-up your points, but you're using the points much more often.
But that said, that's part of the reason for this.
That's part of it.
And the other part of the reason is the age-old thing of credit card companies, no matter what you do.
And that I hadn't thought of until somebody mentioned it on one of the podcasts.
Meteor, Twitter, something. But the thing about it was, it's a good point. And the point is this, is that you end up realizing how much Apple decided to effectively take a hit to benefit consumers. And what that is basically any transaction, they're going to charge you like 2% of the transaction. That's what the credit
Visa
card company is going to charge. Yep. And they're also going to charge a minimum of 25 cents. So if you buy something for 26 cents, the person's going to get one penny. And if you charge something for $1.99, that 2%, they're not going to give them 4 cents. So they're going to give them, they're going to make at least 25 cents on it. So Apple, one of the reasons why when you buy a couple things in a given day, they wait to charge you a little bit so they can bundle it together, because it's going to save them some money. But if you just buy one song for 99 cents, Apple takes a 25% hit on that. If you buy 10 songs for a dollar, they take like a 2% hit
right.
on it. So they're making the choice that, you know, consumers really want that convenience of knowing how much they paid, not worrying beyond that, and we're going to suffer to take that hit. And to a great extent, Microsoft says, boy, we don't want to give up that 25 cents. We want to make sure we get the maximum. And I understand that, but that's them thinking about profits and Apple thinking about consumers.
Because that way Microsoft doesn't have to worry. Microsoft only worries about it when someone buys points.
Exactly.
And not when they and
at
not
a bare
when they,
minimum, they're gonna lose 2%. They're never gonna lose 25%. And Apple is going, but we like consumers. We think consumers would appreciate the convenience with this micropayment, so we're going to let them do it, even though we lose 25% of the sale.
I was a little more sympathetic to Microsoft when I heard that point about the credit transactions, because even though I knew that, I hadn't put it together. That being said, there's nothing stopping Microsoft from saying 1 point equals a penny or 1 point equals a dollar, so that you don't have to do this retarded math in your head.
Well, they should do that, but I mean, the point is, they're still making you buy them in $5, $10, $25
I understand,
increments.
It wouldn't be as consumer unfriendly if you rejiggered the points so that they wouldn't have to do this other psychological thing.
I agree, but it's like the federal government taking our taxes out pre-taken. We're basically giving them a no interest loan for something we may purchase in the future, and we actually can't get a refund for. With Apple, I have never given a no interest loan to Apple for any amount whatsoever. Apple, every purchase I've ever gotten, they've taken it and I've gotten a thing for. Microsoft, I might give them $20 and spend $5 now, and I might not do anything for a while, and they got my $15. That's not consumer friendly. They're just banking on the fact that people won't have another option. They're going to go along with it, and sure, what the heck. That's why if that Apple thing works at front end and the ITV, in a sense, you could say it would be a direct competitor to the Xbox functionality for purchasing movies. But the difference is, if you buy a movie on the Apple thing, let's say both of them, they come out for about the same price. If it's an $11.99 movie that you get to keep, well, on Microsoft, if you have no interest in buying any other movies, you're spending $20 for that movie. On Apple, you're spending $11.99.
That's true.
So that's
my thinking. And I have to think about it, because I mean, it'll be interesting to see how it shakes out, because I have an Xbox 360. It's already plugged in to my HD TV. I do not have an ITV. Yeah. I assumed I was going to get one, but maybe when push comes to shove, I'll say, you know what? That means I have to get a new I'm probably going to get a new laptop anyway. But, you know, it's spending more money to duplicate something I can already do with the 360. It's just a matter of how do I want to implement it, Apple scheme or yep. Microsoft scheme.
That's becoming a big challenge for me too. I totally assumed I'd get the ITV because I'm so focused around iTunes.
And clearly that's why Apple announced it early, yep. So that people will at least know what's happening. They don't have to say, well, I don't know what Apple's going to do and when. I might as yep. well invest in Microsoft. Now people like us at least have to think about it.
But they've really completely beefed up. I mean, effectively, if you have a media center PC, even without one, it works pretty well. But with a media center PC, you can basically do all of the functionality except for buying iTunes shows. So if there's another way to buy these same shows, you know, I don't know. I mean, I think in one level, it's great. Finally, there's real competition. It's giving us awesome choices as opposed to being stuck. So I think it's good. And I think Microsoft's moves with the Xbox are pretty much uniformly good, except I don't like this scheme, but I like at least the direction they're going.
Yeah, I agree. So other big news, PlayStation 3 and Wii essentially out now, or I think Wii is this week.
Wii was the one was 17th. The other's 19th. So Wii is out. Because isn't today
PS3 was
what day's today?
17th.
Oh wait, I thought PS3. Oh no, maybe it was like the 15th and 17th. But yeah, Wii's out at least today.
Although
if you read some of the blogs, you realize like some of the Sears stores, in other words, just had no idea they were supposed to put them on embargo. So this one guy's saying, I went in to get a PlayStation, didn't have anything, and then they saw a Wii box there. Do you have any of those? Yeah, we got about six of them, and they sold them one like on Tuesday.
Good Lord, how do you run? And like, I can understand the store manager maybe being a little out of the
loop. Having worked at Sears, I could see that very easily.
Assumingly there's a department manager. How can you be an electronics department manager and not realize that maybe you're not supposed to put one of the three consoles out early? I have no problem envisioning incompetence anywhere, but to me that's a little. And so anyway, you know, people, all these stories, people standing in line for days to get a PS3, fights breaking out in lines, people getting mugged, people getting shot for a PS3, which is ridiculous.
They technically wasn't getting shot with the PS3. Some thug members realized that there's a whole bunch of people in line probably with actual cash in their wallets, and they robbed them. And
that's kind of hard to believe. How do you, if I'm going to do that, why do I have cash in my wallet? I have perfectly serviceable credit cards.
I know you don't listen to the PC Gamer podcast, but they had a real doozy this last week because they decided to contact Falcon Northwest, probably the premier builder of ultra high end PCs. Uh-huh. So they said, hey, can you give us like, do you have like a super premium machine you can give us for a contest? We're going to go down to line to where these people have been waiting for 3 days for PlayStations. And we're going to offer a brand new high-end $7,000 PC to somebody who's willing to, that will put them their name in a jar, but to step out of line and sign an agreement saying, I will not buy a PlayStation. I will not have one given to me for the next 3 years. And in exchange, I will get this PC. And literally every single person at the front of the line put their name in the hat, and this one guy got one and won it. So they were all proud of themselves, you know, for this. Well, anyway, their European editor was on the podcast, and he would not let up saying how stupid of a thing, how little that proved, how it meant nothing. And they were feeling so proud of themselves. And he was so right on the money pointing out how little what their little game thing proved. Uh-huh. Anyway, I thought it was kind of funny they got that, but it was like the most uncomfortable podcast I ever heard because he wouldn't like bend, and they were trying to like joke it along. He's going, no, it prove nothing. This is the stupidest thing. This guy, and the guy was like, you know, I knew it was kind of funny, but what I found is funny is the PlayStation not getting such great reviews. We getting phenomenal reviews, and it was kind of funny when we made that point about we're not going with higher graphics, heavier graphics.
It's essentially a game. It's a slightly spiffier GameCube internally,
and everybody, but because they announced their weaknesses and said that's not our strength anyway, so we're not going to focus on the graphics. That took that off the table, and everybody, all the reviewers, got to focus on the other thing. And of course, this apparently wonderful nunchuck stick thing that they have, the wireless thing, which I don't know, I haven't used them, but I look at those controllers, and they look to me very prototype. They're perfectly boxy. They don't have a feel like the Xbox 360 is about the most well-designed game pad I've ever seen. These ones here are a box, and it's got like a number, a one and two. I don't know. For some reason, it doesn't look like it was designed to fit in somebody's hand, but nobody's complaining. They're saying it's a wonderful machine. So I kind of would like to test one out.
Yeah, I haven't held the controller either. But interesting. One of my managers at work told me the other day that she was getting a Wii.
Yep.
And she, I don't know. He's like in her 30s, late 30s. Just had a kid. Totally, not someone I would ever peg as a video game player because I'm a judgmental stereotypist. But so that kind of shocked me. She's like, "Oh yeah, I'm gonna get the Wii. I'm not gonna get any work done next week." And I was like, "Okay."
Well, even though they put Call of Duty like released it on the day of, it doesn't strike me that's their typical kind of game. So it's probably more arcade style, and maybe this is sexist of me, but I assume Call of Duty games are not women oriented, but the ones where there's a lot more even distribution are those arcade styles. So maybe, I don't know, PlayStation just strikes me as the kind of thing that appeals to very hardcore people.
I had I knew some people that said they were going to go wait in line just so they could flip them on eBay and make the profit. And one guy that was actually going to do it, I asked, he showed up late the day after, and I said, "Oh, so how'd your thing go?" And he's like, "Oh, we didn't go. When we showed up to the Federal Way Best Buy at 6 a.m. the morning before, there were already 25 people in line for 20 consoles." If you're the 25th person, what are you thinking? Yeah. Are you thinking that one of the others is going to go away? Because you're investing like 24 hours.
Yeah.
I
don't honestly understand any of that. I enjoy games. I don't understand the waiting in line for that. I guess I'm older.
I don't care that much. B, I have a job. C, I have a life.
Yeah.
Anyway, so it'll be interesting to see what happens now that they're finally out and now that we can finally see some actual comparisons, even though launch games always kind of suck.
Yeah.
It's funny. I remember the marketing push behind Perfect Dark Zero. They were really pushing that as this is going to be, they didn't say this was going to be the Halo of the 360 until Halo 3 comes out, but they were really like, this is an awesome game and Joanna Dark and this and that. And it came out and it was buggy. Everyone was like, "Whoa, put this back in the oven. It is not done." And it just completely fell flat.
Yeah. Well, I'm happy with mine, although I wish Guitar Hero was not a PlayStation game, because
they're coming out with a Guitar Hero for the 360.
Are they? I was looking. I was trying to see if they do, because I think I'll be getting that. The more I look at it, the more I see all the bands they have in there, and it's like all music from like the 80s hardcore that are heavy metal that I like. So I thought, oh boy, I really am a dork, and I will probably get that, even though they charge you so much because you got to get that stupid.
If I were you, I would lower the blinds when you play that game.
Oh, I will. They're usually
lowered. You don't
want to
be putting on a show for your neighbors.
But I'll almost certainly get that game if and when it comes out.
A submitted email thing we're supposed to talk about here.
What's up?
Halo, Bungie last week, because it was like the 5th anniversary of Halo coming out, announced a bunch of different stuff. And one of them is that they're going to release a multiplayer Halo 3 demo in the spring.
Yeah, I heard about that. In advance of Halo 3,
which is somewhat odd. I'm sure it's to keep the fires going, because now that Gears of War is out, suddenly the need for Halo 3 diminishes.
I agree, but then, and they're both published by Microsoft, but one is a
different
developer.
Different studios, Bungie and Epic.
Yeah, so I agree, so that's probably why, but I think to some extent, I don't know, to some extent they know that they've got a brand that people are going to latch onto, and how many times have you heard like a great game, a great multiplayer, but it's so screwed up? Like with Battlefield 14 or 1942 and all these other ones that were great, and people just played through it even though the multiplayer experience was so buggy. And it's almost like they said, boy, this could be a monster. Why not just get a half a million beta testers? We know they're going to buy the game. We know it. And we know when they enjoy it, once the game comes out, we're going to turn off that free thing.
Well, there's a couple other things going on here. One, I don't know if my mic's too far. They also announced a public beta.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think also in the spring, which is bizarre. Two, it's been pointed out because Gears of War didn't have a demo, and they said, well, you know what? Making a demo takes resources away from making the game.
Yep.
So that's an interesting choice they made. They're sacrificing making the game come out a little earlier or having as many resources to actually play the game that are on this demo now. So that was an interesting choice to make. And beyond that, I'm not sure to the degree they need to demo multiplayer on Halo. Halo 2 multiplayer, prior to Gears of War, the most played game on Xbox Live. So they're getting a lot of data from that. I don't know to what degree they're going to change things. They also have a pretty large internal testing system. And that's, if you listen to the Major Nelson podcasts, every so often, because when he's talking to internal people, he asks them, what's your tag? What's your gamer score? And they always say, oh, I have a really low gamer score. And part of the reason is all these guys are also playing on the internal Microsoft demo betaing things on a demo on an internal version of Xbox Live that doesn't accrue gamer points the way it would if they were playing in the real system.
Yeah.
And so I don't know the number of people that are on that internal, I want to call it friendly net. I think I've heard it referred to as that, but their internal dev platform.
But at a certain point, you're right.
So I think by now Microsoft has enough experience with Xbox Live and what's going on that they I'm not sure they need to do huge scale tests, which would be the big difference between half a million people playing it and, I don't know, 5,000 playing it.
So let's say that that isn't the issue. It's not testing. It's just sheer utter PR goodwill of getting people, getting their appetite whetted, getting them to mentally move away from the thought of doing Halo 2 and going, I'm moving into Halo 3 now. I'm kind of used to this, and I know if I want to keep playing this, and now everybody else says I got to go buy the thing. You know, that was one of the problems with what's the one that was based on Half-Life, the game that everybody played. It was a mod that people had did, and it was like
Fear?
I can't remember. No, it was using the Half-Life engine. They made the great all-time, open source game thing or whatever. But the problem is once they updated the game, everybody else is going, well, the old one's just fine. We like the old one. Half the super gamers, on at least on the PC realm, they would just turn the graphics way down so it could go even faster. So they had this real problem selling the new one because nobody could care. At least with this one here, they could at least get people using the new one because it's free. They'll get used to it because maybe they're worried that, God dang. I look at Halo 2 right now and I go, wow, Halo 2 is the number one played game on Xbox Live, and it's not even an Xbox 360 game. And so what they found out about that is there is literally millions of people that are willing to give up cruddy graphics for good gameplay. Well, so what happens when the new one comes out?
But Gears of War has awesome graphics and people are liking the gameplay.
No, I'm not saying they're not. I'm not saying they're not. I'm just saying that at least with Xbox, at least it's shown that there wasn't, when Xbox 360 came out and you could play it on there, people said, well, I'll keep doing that. So I think maybe to some extent they're going, we want to make sure that people... We want to make sure we get every last person to migrate to the new system. So let's give them a reason to. Let's get them used to the new one because we don't want them going, the old one's just fine. I don't know. I'm trying to think about why. They haven't really explained why. That's my best guess for understanding why.
We'll see. It's interesting, and we'll see what happens. When they were launching the 360, a lot of a line I heard used a lot was, first company to 10 million units wins.
Yep.
I haven't heard that number. I haven't heard that line at all in the past few months.
What's 360 up to about
like
now?
Like 6.
Yeah.
I mean, they fully expect to reach 10 million first.
Yeah.
And to win that battle. And yet I haven't heard that line in a while. So I think they realized, you know what? That may not be the case. Maybe PlayStation does win even though they're not first to 10 million. So we'll see what happens.
I don't know if they're going to show a replay, but they're driving Favre off the field in the little cart, and they almost clipped a dude from New England and knocked him over. Literally, I kid you not, they almost ran over one of the New England players.
When you're Green Bay and you're down 21 points, and Brett Favre is carted off with an injury, you might as well go home.
You might as well start clipping players. But I'm increasingly thinking that. Both companies are going to win. It was always one's going to win and be dominant. And given the success, that unparalleled success of the 360, and given how I think that the PlayStation is going to be very successful, I think both will win.
Well, we'll see. I mean, it's so, you know, Sony has placed a gigantic bet, and if people don't step up, it'll be really interesting to see what happens with them.
Yeah. So what else on the list there, Kimo?
Not too much. Actually, just one other thing that was emailed to us was the whole Justin Long thing, but...
Oh, about from the Mac. Yeah, Justin Long being the good Mac guy and Joel Hodgman being the PC.
John Hodgman.
John Hodgman being the...
Yeah, and apparently he was fired, but then he wasn't. But then he said, no, I'm showing up to a shoot later today.
Oh, so he's not.
Yeah, apparently that was just like a BS.
I just don't get it. I it's ridiculous. Of course you're going to laugh at the PC guy. But I don't find the one guy snarky. I don't find bad.
I'm reluctant to discuss this because it seems like every other podcast I listen to has discussed this.
Okay, here's one angle. Have you seen the Japanese versions of them?
No.
If you go to apple.jp, it's the identical website. And then you click on, this must be, QuickTime. And then you click on it. And then it's the identical thing, only they're speaking Japanese. It's the funniest damn thing to see it reduced to a visual look and feel, but with different language. So, well, anyway, we're looking at a Quest ad.
That was bizarre.
Because we're not seeing any, actually hearing what's going on. It made no sense. It was like some guy wiping.
I think it was a Seahawk promo.
Oh, I thought it looked like an owl, but you're right. A Seahawk, of course. But so it's like a real Seahawk or something.
Anyway, I mean, so basically people were saying that the general public doesn't like the Apple guy because he's too smarmy, and they're more sympathetic towards the PC guy because he's John Hodgman and he's funny.
Does that mean they're sympathetic to PCs?
Apparently, that's the perceived problem. And somebody's saying, well, you know what? Mac guys are kind of smarmy and snarky. Yeah, and
that's the irony.
So maybe Apple doesn't see that as an issue. You know, I can see all that. But since I'm not a potential switcher anyway, I don't.
I like the ads.
I think
they're
great advertising. They're great marketing. Yeah. They're using two talented actors. I think both actors are very good.
I think they're fine. I mean, if they brought back Ellen Feist, I might even be happier. Oh, but as it stands right now, you know, I saw this thing. She's in some movie, some French movie. Like, she's an actress, and I saw one of those Ellen Feist shrines, and the only bit of information they had about her is that she's in this other movie, that so they have, like, screen captures, and there's literally no other news about Ellen Feist. But anyway. Well,
last thing on my list, the Sonics, because it is entertainment-related.
Yep.
We never said what we did at the beginning. We talk about things in the entertainment industry that capture our interest.
Yep. And I guess the Sonics pass for entertainment.
So the Seattle Supersonics, our local basketball team, was purchased by an owner's group based out of Oklahoma City.
Yep. America's big cities without a major league sports franchise.
Sonics have been trying for years to get a renovation on their existing arena, Key Arena, or to get a new arena built. They were talking about sort of the port area south of the port, or moving to the suburbs, Bellevue or Renton.
And it's important to note the Seattle Supersonics really forced this hand 10 years ago by forcing a renovation.
And that was two owners ago.
Yeah. And what they did was they wanted a renovation. They forced the city to pay a bunch of money to renovate the arena,
which is city owned.
Yeah. But they very specifically wanted it to be, in terms of the number of people that could fit in the place, smaller than they were worried about the competition of an NHL team, and they didn't want the NHL in there, so they made them rebuild it.
200 seats is what I've heard.
Yeah, 200 seats shorter than the bare minimum limit for an NHL franchise, which is ironic because the NHL is just totally messed up. But so they rebuilt a really small stadium,
which was just finished in like 94, 95.
Yeah, we're talking about a decade ago. It was later. Yeah, it was like right about then.
Because it was about when I moved here.
Yep, exactly. And now they're bemoaning that they have this tiny little stadium when it was them doing it. And the problem is that we just financed in very difficult positions two other stadiums. People are not in the mood anymore to finance stadiums.
So the Sonics are saying we need more capacity for tickets, and we need more luxury boxes because to be equal to other franchises around the country. And you're right. you know, the taxpayers were asked to fund a baseball, a new baseball stadium. They said no. The local politicians did a deal anyway. Taxpayers did approve a Seahawks stadium with some help from cajillionaire Paul Allen. He paid like $100 million of the whatever it cost.
And he funded the election, too. It was a statewide election.
Yeah. And so taxpayers are sick and tired of funding stadiums. And add to the fact the Sonics have not been good lately, and they're bellyaching about something that, you're right, it's like 10 years old. And the Kingdome was 20 years old and was literally falling apart.
Yep.
So there was more of a thing to point to and say, you know what? You can objectively say the Kingdome is not as good as any number of other baseball and or football stadiums. With Key Arena, you can say maybe it's not as nice as a new one, but it's not horrendous.
Yeah,
it's only it's pretty nice.
Yeah.
And so this, and 10 years ago. Well, you're the jackasses that said you didn't want a bigger stadium, and now you want us to fund it again?
Yeah.
A gigantic, and so the last election day, there was a local initiative to ban public financing of stadiums,
and
which
it passed,
very,
very high passage.
And so now the Sonics, the owners, if they can't work out another deal that doesn't involve public financing, or they move it to Bellevue or Renton, two of the suburbs, which have not passed a ban, and it doesn't seem that likely.
Here's the irony. They're talking about this, and the owners are as believable as not, with their eyes wide open, going, no, we want to figure out a way to stay in this town.
And they're saying there's basically a year.
Yeah.
We have a year to work out a deal, and then we don't know what's going to happen.
Here's what they're actually saying. We want to have the perception that there's a possibility they might stay in this town so we can get an even better deal back in Oklahoma City. There is no chance they're going to stay here. There's no chance there's a Bellevue deal going to work out. There's none. They just need leverage, because if it's clear they're moving, they have no leverage back in Oklahoma City. They want to maximize whatever they want.
Well, I think there is, you know, I think they're being honest, but
I don't think they're being honest at all.
They put a reasonable deadline saying a year. You know what? We're from Oklahoma City. You're probably right that we're going to move it, but maybe we can work something out in a year. And if they can, you know, it really is all about money. If they can make more money keeping the team in Seattle, that's what they're going to do.
Yeah.
Regardless of the fact that they're from Oklahoma. It's not likely, because no one's going to fork over here.
Well, what I think is interesting is the marketing. This year's marketing message is the most important season ever. And subtly what they're saying is they got to do good. You got to come out, because there's a possibility if you really support them, they'll stick around. What a bizarre way of marketing a sports team.
It's also like their 40th season.
Yeah.
So that's the ostensible reason for that marketing. But everyone knows what's going on.
I love the history of the Sonics. I love the fact that they were, other than the Seattle Metropolitans winning the Stanley Cup in 1922, they're our first big national champion team, and I remember all that, but I really don't like basketball that much, and B, how it's played out, they don't make it so I can like it. I've loved sports because I've got to see them live, and there's such a high barrier for me seeing the Sonics live in terms of costs that it's clearly not geared for me. The cheapest tickets are like $40 to $50, and those are really bad tickets. And if I can't just go see them live, if it's not accessible, I'm not into it. I don't know where all their money goes, because they charge a fortune for these tickets. They have what, like 120 games a year or something. So there's got to be.
I think it's their lease with the city. I don't know if it's like they have to split ticket revenue with the city, or if it's just a flat fee. But that's the issue. Other teams don't have to deal with the lease conditions, and the answer to that is, well, you shouldn't have agreed to it when you signed the lease. That's your problem, dummy. And so you're right. It's interesting that, and you know, there was an article in the Times, I think it was you that emailed it to me, you know, Sonics are set to leave as Seattle shrugs.
Well, that was in the New York Times.
Yeah, the New York Times, not the Seattle Times. And they're right. Essentially, everyone in Seattle is saying, we don't care.
We're just tired of it. It's been 10 years.
We've got the Mariners, who suck right now. We have the Seahawks that are doing well.
Yep.
We've got enough to do.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, aren't we like the most educated city in the country?
Yeah, we're the one city that that has fallen for the, oh, we can't lose our sports team, and we're the one that's leading a trend to go, you know what, maybe we can move on. And it drives some people nuts, but I'm sort of the, I don't want to lose a sports team, but I also think that there's a whole lot other things we have going for us than to worry about losing
them. There
was
a local NPR story talking, you know, interviewing people, and God help me, I loathe man on the street interviews.
Yeah.
And they interviewed somebody saying, well, it's the Seattle Supersonics. Can't be anyone else. Supersonics can't be. Getting all in a lather. And it's like, yeah, I'm sure they won't rename the team.
Although, don't forget, you know, it used to be the New Orleans Jazz.
Yeah.
And then they moved to that bastion of jazz music, Salt Lake City, Utah. And they kept it. I've never understood why they kept the name. It made no sense to me. I think they were trying for consistency, but in retrospect, it made no sense. But God bless them, they stuck with it.
There is zero chance that the Sonics move to Oklahoma City. They will retain the name Supersonics.
I mean, if they move to like Wichita, which has Boeing and other stuff.
Yeah, which has a substantial aircraft
Oklahoma
presence.
City, it's going to be some horse, some Indian, or some related name like that. Simple.
Do you really think it would be an Indian name if you were starting
a
name?
No, I don't mean an Indian name. I mean one that honors them in a way that... you're right. Even no matter what you do, they don't want to go down that path.
Well, you and I wouldn't, would they?
Yeah, that's a good point. But, you know, I mean, like, to some extent, the Seahawks have adopted a motif based around coastal Indian culture. Their logo, which we've all gotten used to, but it's completely a contrived version of a Tlingit or a Salish type Indian logo, and I love it. I always thought it was really cool. And the name Seahawk is somewhat emblematic of that.
Well, because there's no such thing as a Seahawk.
But I don't think they would ever dare go down that path, even in the middle of what used to be known as Indian territory. I don't think
probably
they would do that.
Not. I mean, because there's this line of, well, what's an offensive name and what isn't an offensive name? Like, Redskins is an offensive name, but Chiefs is not.
Yeah. Braves is brave.
An offensive name, but God, is there another one is there another non-offensive Indian name? But apparently
the
like
Vicious Head Scalpers. That's not particularly
like apparently offensive. Chiefs isn't that offensive.
It all depends. They're all offensive to somebody.
And I don't think, I mean,
but the Indians, the Cleveland Indians is offensive, but Chief Wahoo is particularly offensive.
I am not overly politically correct,
yeah,
but this is an instant where I think it's offensive and the names should be changed. I don't care what it costs.
Yep.
I understand tradition.
Yep.
I understand honoring your tradition. And certainly, you know, you've got years and years and years and years of built up brand identity,
yep,
but it's still wrong.
I agree totally. You know, all the way up until like the 50s, there was maybe it was the 60s. There was some small college in the Midwest somewhere, and their team name was, well, I won't say it, but I'll spell out the first letters. It's NIGGER Heads. That was their team. My favorite, of course, the favorite team was the local team when I lived in British Columbia for Simon Fraser University, the Clan.
Is that awful? Well, that's the best right now is it Stephen Cobeagle Eagles?
Oh, I know. I love Stephen Colbert.
Is it a high school team? It's like a high school hockey team.
Yeah, it's like a high
school.
They
renamed their mascot like Stephen Cobeagle or something like that. And it's the Stephen Cobeagle Eagles. Yeah. What a brilliant school. Because he mentions them like every couple of weeks.
I know.
Clearly, we're winding down. Yep. Although, one last thing about the Bond thing.
Yep.
It's interesting how your perceptions change. And like, you know, I used to work at an animal organization.
Yep.
As did you.
Yep.
And watching James Bond, there's a scene towards the beginning where there's a girl riding a horse on a beach.
Yep.
And one thing I did when I was much younger, I actually worked and went to a horse camp.
Cool.
Because that's what I did.
Yep.
And I know from working there, you really shouldn't have horses on beaches. It's very easy for them to snap an ankle.
Is it really?
It is.
Oh, and for like running or?
Just.
Because I know locally at Long Beach, you know, in Washington here, they have this enormous amounts of beach and you can, and they have horses go down there, but I don't think they gallop. I think they just kind of walk.
I admit, I'm not sure if there's a distinction between running and walking, but generally speaking, it's bad for the horses because they can turn an ankle.
I had no idea.
And so every time, and I learned that you know, when I was literally 15.
Yeah.
And so now every time I see a horse on a beach, that's what I think. I see a horse. Huh. The odds may not be that good. And certainly when you're on the firmer, wetter sand, it's easier.
Yeah.
But still, that's what I think. I'm like, that is not necessary. That hurts the horse. Which yeah, is, there's the political correctness rearing its ugly
well,
head.
Well, it's funny. The new movie Fast Food Nation came out in limited release last week.
Which I had no idea that opened this weekend until
I
heard.
Well, it was kind of in limited release, and it's no secret because they're pointing this out that the movie is based on that book by Eric Schlosser, which examines McDonald's. Although in this movie, it's like this Mickey's company. Well, the movie ends with a little trip to the old slaughterhouse, and it shows very real images of real animals suffering and dying and then being cut up. And I'm ambivalent about all of this because there's been movies in the past where I've seen they've taken real animals and they've done something to them and they're using it as an artistic decision so we can feel the movie as all that more real. And it drives me nuts. Famously, The Wild Bunch, they had a bunch of horses on a bridge and they blew the bridge and these horses with their riders on them fell 20 feet into the water. And as you're watching that, you can't help but go, oh my God. Because it's not a bunch of actors standing on a bridge. It's a bunch of horses that have no idea what's going on. Mm-hmm. And there was this movie by Michael Haneke, which is one of my favorite directors. He's an Austrian director, directed this awesome movie called Funny Games. He directed Cash last year, which got all this buzz. Well, prior to that, he did a movie called The Year of the Wolf or something like that.
Uh-huh.
And the movie it takes place in this post-nuclear apocalypse, and it's kind of low budget, and it's really a downer of a movie. And at one point, the camera just kind of passes by a guy who takes a donkey and shoots it in the head. And it's pretty clear this is a real donkey who's really getting shot in the head. And later in the movie, they show a goat or a donkey or something getting its neck cut open as blood spurts out and it dies. And this is stuff that goes on in real life, mm-hmm. but they chose to put this in the movie to have us think of the movie as more real. And I find few things more troubling to me than a director going, I don't have enough skills to generate this emotion that I actually have to pull in elements of a real world to do that. So it troubles me. But that said, a horse running on a beach, they're not trying to put horse in jeopardy. They're just trying to get something.
It's an arrest. You know, there's a hot chick.
Horse exactly. Beach. And you're not thinking that. But I remember watching that Project X, which was a movie, Matthew Broderick, about these Air Force monkeys.
Oh, God. I saw that with my friend Preston at I think it was the UA6 in Redwood City.
And it was actually a pretty good movie. It had a good message. But God dang, I read about that and how these animals were really not treated well in making this movie. And I'm thinking, oh, man, I don't know. Although I think another about to make a movie about this ice skating chimp and baseball playing chimp. And but then PETA and some other groups got a hold of him, convinced him, you know, you should probably figure out a way to get somebody in a monkey suit and some audio animatronics because this is not going to come out well. So they did it. And it was this movie with Matt LeBlanc, and it was called Ed. And it was the creepiest thing ever because this thing did not look like a chimp. It looked like a little midget in a monkey suit, and it was terrible. So you can, I don't know what the answer
is.
Funny.
You say that like an ice skating chimp that can play baseball, and I immediately think that sounds like a throwaway joke in The Simpsons, like when they do their hail to the chimp or he goes to the drive-in, and that's what happens when you don't hail to the chimp.
Yeah.
It sounds like a totally manufactured.
Well, and that's basically what it was. And every to the extent that like dogs in movies, I think are great because dogs, they're human companions and you can get them to do something. But if you ever put an animal in jeopardy, it's disturbing to me because it seems like a lazy artistic choice to influence my emotions. And it worked, but it angers me too. Anyway, we are at 113, second longest ever.
Oh, you and your
sorry.
I think we're about done because you have to leave soon anyway.
I do. Got a board meeting.
You guys rock at mustardayonnaise.com. If you have a question, comment, concern, something you'd like us to comment on, like we did a few times this week.
Absolutely.
So you guys rock. I guess, but I don't know if we're going to do one next week because it's Thanksgiving weekend.
Oh, that's
week,
right.
And I'm in Southern Oregon.
Oh, you're going down to your folks?
Mom's house down cool. Southern Oregon.
Cool.
And don't know if we're coming back Saturday or Sunday, but cool. Either way, might not be time for this.
Well, maybe it's in 2 weeks.
We've got Deja Vu coming out.
Oh, yeah. I'm looking forward to that.
That does look interesting. We've got The Fountain coming out. Really looking forward to see The Fountain, although more and more, Wells keeps saying it's a stoner movie. You need to be baked to really enjoy it.
Oh, and it's one of those things where I keep reading a little too much about it, and it's making me mad. I'm avoiding anything about Perfume.
Yeah, that was an Aronofsky article in Wired.
That one wasn't it, but there was something else where somebody just said one little. I'm not going to. But they said this. Oh, but this. And it's like, wow. Why? You're giving clearly now the whole time in the movie, I'm going to be thinking this other direction.
Because so, I like Aronofsky. I like Hugh Jackman. I really like Rachel Weisz.
Yep.
And
you heard what happened last week.
Oh no.
She's pregnant and she gives some interview to the press to say that after the first 3 months, there's no problem with drinking. Oh. I think it was a throwaway thing and she did this a bit, but oh my God, is she getting savaged? So anyway, I digress. Let's wrap it up.
Okay. Thank you for listening. We might be back next week. We might not. It might take us a week to get this one loaded up. So you might not even notice the difference. I am Matt.
I am Richard.
Thanks for listening.
Au revoir.